the 37th study of the Apocalypse, held at the Enfield Christadelphian Hall on the 26th of April 1977. Brother John Knowles speaking to the subject, the Mid-Heaven Proclamation, and the reading, Revelation chapter 14.
The study of the Revelation this evening with the singing of hymn 198, after which we'll open with prayer. Hymn 198. We'd like to extend a welcome to our visiting brother from interstate, and we'd also like to extend a welcome to all the brethren and sisters, of course, who listen to this class through the aid of tape recorders. Our reading for this evening is to be taken from Revelation chapter 14, the 14th chapter of the book of the Revelation, and we're going to read that together through the voice of Brother Richard Cheek. Revelation chapter 14.
Reading together Revelation chapter 14. And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his Father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps, and they sung as it were a new song before the throne, and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. These are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the firstfruits unto God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation, and kindred, and tongue, and people, saying with a loud voice, Fear God, and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come, and worship him that made heaven, and earth, and the sea, and the fountains of waters. And there followed another angel, saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, If any man worship the beast and his image, and receive his mark in his forehead, or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night, who worship the beast and his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, Write, Blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labours, and their works do follow them. And I looked, and behold a white cloud, and upon the cloud one sat like unto the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. And another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him that sat on the cloud, Thrust in thy sickle, and reap, for the time is come for thee to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. And he that sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. And another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven, he also having a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar, which had power over fire, and cried with a loud cry to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, Thrust in thy sharp sickle, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. And the angel thrust in his sickle into the earth, and gathered the vine of the earth, and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden without the city, and the blood came out of the winepress, even unto the horse bridles, by the space of 1,600 furlongs.
The title for our class tonight is The Mid-Heaven Proclamation. We'll now ask Brother John to lead us in that address.
My dear class members, well, at our last class, which was now quite a few weeks ago, we commenced Revelation chapter 14, so I think it would be a very good idea if we spent the first 2 or 3 minutes just recapping what we saw in those first 5 verses of the 14th chapter. We must always bear in mind the fundamental theme of the Apocalypse, and that is that it is the theme of God manifestation, not just merely the theme of presenting before us certain events as they are going to happen in the earth, particularly in chronological order, because they are not set out in chronological order, they're set out thematically. And this comes very forcibly to our attention in that opening verse, when we've got the picture there of the Lord Jesus Christ in company with the redeemed standing on Mount Zion, and we find the Lord described as a lamb. And as we've mentioned many times in our classes, this may seem strange to us, because we've always thought in the past that the lamb was a symbol of the Lord at his first advent, whereas the Lord at his second advent would be that of a lion. Well, of course, in its simplest form, that is true, but it goes much further than that. When we look at the Apocalypse thematically, we see that whilst the Lord is described here in Revelation chapter 14 verse 1 at his second advent and not at his first advent, he is still described as a lamb. Now, why is that? Well, it's because the theme of the chapter is not so much the theme of God pouring out judgments upon nations, but rather it is showing the work of the redeemed. Now, really, the subject is the same. It depends on which angle you look at it from. The theme of Revelation chapter 14 is how the redeemed are going to perform the work of God. And inasmuch as the main subject is the subject of the redeemed, therefore the Lord, in relationship to this group, must be symbolized as a lamb, because it speaks about these as being those who have been redeemed. We get that word in verse 4. Therefore, the Lord, in relationship to the redeemed, is as a lamb. is as that sacrificial lamb. So it was because the Lord was sacrificed that those people could be the redeemed. It is therefore the lamb that constitutes them the redeemed, not the lion. So consequently, we see brought to our attention very forcibly and very beautifully that the Lord here is the lamb in relationship to that group who stand with him. Now, nevertheless, even as the lamb, he is going to go forward now with the redeemed, and ultimately he's going to pour out the judgments of God upon the nations subsequent to Armageddon. I say subsequent to Armageddon, and that means after Armageddon, because this picture which we have here in these opening verses is of the Lord now together with the redeemed standing on Mount Zion. And we remember the words of verses 2 and 3 in particular, that here they were gathered together now as a rejoicing community. And that very beautiful symbol of the harpers harping with their harps describes to us the joy which these people were bringing to God. As Brother Thomas points out, that the saint himself is the harp of deity. The saint himself is the harp of deity. And as we read in Ephesians, that we should make melody with striking the strings with our heart unto the Lord. So the picture then here of the harp, or the saint rather, being the harp of deity, it is his heart, therefore, which constitutes the means by which that harp may make a pleasant sound. And therefore hearts full of thanksgiving are like harps which render a pleasant song before the Lord. And at this stage, of course, they are now immortalized. And these are the songs of all ages now brought to their culmination as they are described as harpers harping with their harps. The saints now rejoicing before Yahweh. We are told the basis upon which they have attained unto this position in verses 4 and 5. We are told these are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. Now, there was a very important point out of verse 4 that I didn't make last time, and so I'm going to make it initially in the form of a question. I don't mean that you've got to answer it to me, but try to answer it to yourself. We see the picture here of the saints under another theme of being this chaste virgin unto Christ. They are the bride of Christ, aren't they? And we are told that they were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. How do we get that theme worked out? They are not defiled with women, but they are women. They are the chaste bride, the chaste virgin unto Christ, but they are here being commended because they have not been defiled with women. One would think that if the symbol is spiritual adultery, that one would have to say they have not been defiled with men, whatever the men might stand as representative of in the anti-typical sense. But it doesn't say that. It says they are not defiled with women. How then do we work out this theme? Can you see the problem? I mean, adultery means if one party is a bride, then the adulterous relationship must be with a man who is not her husband. But these women are commended because they have not defiled themselves with women. We've got the question? Now, have we got the answer? Well, we've got the answer. Well, just, you can suggest it by all means. Yes. Well, it wasn't that hard after all. I can see everybody nodding. Yes, that's it, you see. It's not really so much the case here of spiritual adultery in the strictest sense of the term. It's the fact that this woman, or this system which is going to be judged later on this chapter, is essentially this Roman system, which is the apostate woman. Now, there are two themes which go through the apocalypse. There is the theme of the bride, which started off being a chaste virgin under Christ, but became a corrupt church. So we'll style it the ecclesia in the first instance, which was a chaste virgin under Christ. She became a corrupt church system through spiritual adultery with the kings of the earth. Now, that's the adulterous system. The kings of the earth committed fornication with her. Therefore, it was the Roman political system
which corrupted the true ecclesia and formed the Roman Catholic Church. You know, after the anti-type of what we saw in the Garden of Eden. Now that's spiritual adultery. So the church having been formed, she is now a corrupt woman. But the true bride is commended because they did not follow this corrupt woman. And so you see the truth down through the ages, the ecclesia, generally does not deteriorate because some political power has come along and destroyed her. Although, of course, around the time of Constantine there was that merger. But down through the ages, the history of the decline of the true ecclesia is not so much because some political power has come along and destroyed it, but because that true ecclesia has been drawn away to become part of the corrupt woman. In other words, because the true ecclesia fails to see its separateness from the church system. Now, have we got the two patterns then? In the first instance, the true ecclesia got drawn away by the political Roman power, the serpent. The serpent beguiled her, just like the serpent beguiled Eve. She became allied with another husband, and she brought forth the man-child of sin, Constantine, the anti-type of Cain. Right. That's one pattern. That woman now having been formed, the challenge to the true ecclesia thereafter is, don't follow that corrupt woman. In other words, don't be defiled with these women. And so that is the pattern which we've got set there. Might we take the opportunity, therefore, brethren and sisters, to suggest very strongly that this is the challenge which the truth must face in all ages, and none of us can feel safe or sure in our situation that it won't happen to us. I say this because I feel very strongly that this is a great problem which is facing our brotherhood at this stage. To what extent it faces the Enfield Ecclesia, I don't know, because I'm probably too close to it like the rest of you to necessarily see where we're heading. But one doesn't have to look very far outside to realise that separation from the world, and I'm not talking just in a moral sense here, but in the general sense of our attitude towards the apostasy, is this separation is breaking down. We are finding in many places that Christadelphians no longer call themselves Christadelphians, they call themselves Christians. That the word ecclesia has disappeared from the vocabulary and they are churches. And so they talk about the Christian church rather than the Christadelphian ecclesia. You may say, well, that's not very important. What's in a word? Well, sometimes it isn't important. Sometimes a person might use a word rather loosely. But when you see other things allied with it, and when you see them talking about the good people in the churches and how we must draw closer to these people and how we can do something for them, and you see a decline in standards, it's very, very worrying indeed. And articles in some of our Christadelphian magazines indicate to us that in many parts of the world they recognise this decline, particularly amongst young people. And they say, well, we don't really know what to do about it. We must try and do something. That young people are going off to more Pentecostal type churches because there seems to be more appeal there. And then one rationalises and says, well, you know, I suppose it's better than going there than going into the world. And many of these people who've gone and joined the Pentecostal churches really haven't changed their beliefs, you know. They still believe the same as us. And this sort of rationalising can become very plausible. And when we can't handle a situation, we say, well, it's better that they went there than that they left the church altogether. And step by step, this comes upon us. And honestly, brethren and sisters, I don't know whether you read the same magazines as I do, but this is a problem. And you don't have to read magazines. You can talk to people, frankly, in this city, and you can see that this is a very serious problem. Now, these people were commended because they were not defiled with the woman. They were able to see that the truth is a set of doctrines and a way of life which is separate from this. And so I would like to just take this opportunity as a reminder. I'm sure we're all very conscious of it, but we do need to be reminded of this, because this is the danger that the world, either in a doctrinal sense or, of course, in a moral sense, will creep in and draw us away, that whilst we will still believe, quote, the truth in inverted commas, the truth will have been so watered down and so merged with the general system that we no longer constitute that true and faithful virgin unto Christ. These people were commended because they followed the Lamb whithersoever he went, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb, and in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. And as we mentioned last time, it didn't mean to say that they were absolutely sinless in the strictest sense of the term, because there is not one of us that can ever attain unto a state of absolute sinlessness. But as far as God is concerned, they were one with the Lamb. They were completely united in him, therefore their sins were covered, therefore they were imputed righteous, they were accounted righteous, and in that sense they were accounted faultless before him. Well, now this presents to us the picture of this group as they are now gathered together with the Lamb, rejoicing with him over the initial victory which has taken place at Armageddon. As we've mentioned in many previous studies, Armageddon is virtually a token overthrow of the nations. When we get the Gogian host coming down into the land, we've got the overthrow of Russia and of some of her satellites, and we've got, therefore, the Lord established in Zion, reigning over what the doctor styles the stone kingdom of Judah. Now, he calls it the stone kingdom because, you know, in Daniel chapter 2, that small stone which smote the image on the feet and eventually ground to powder and eventually grew until it became a great mountain, filled the whole earth, grows in a series of stages. The first stage is when the stone smites the image on the feet and knocks it over. At that stage, the Lord Jesus Christ establishes himself in Zion, reigning over essentially the territory promised to Abraham. He has cleansed the land. He started from Sinai and he's marched up. He's cleansed the area of Teman. He's gone down into Egypt and he's come up into the land. He's defeated the Gogian host in the Syrian area. So he now reigns over that area promised to Abraham. It now becomes necessary to extend his dominion right throughout the earth. And that becomes then the work of the next 40 years, which are described from verses 6 to 11 under the heading of the work of three angels. So then here in verses 6 to 11, we've got the first angel of verse 6, the second angel of verse 8, and the third angel of verse 9, performing three series of events which will ultimately bring the whole earth into subjugation, into subjection to the Lord. Now the Lord still follows those principles which he set in motion from the beginning. He still is prepared to offer them mercy before judgment. And so the first proclamation in verses 6 and 7 is essentially a merciful proclamation. Those who don't hearken to it are then given another warning as a token judgment in verse 8 is poured out upon the city Babylon itself. And then those who still will not hearken to that finally must succumb to the judgments of verses 9 to 11. So then this section in verses 6 to 11 consists of those judgments which the Lord is going to pour out upon the nations subsequent to the Battle of Armageddon. So we're going to have a look then first of all at what is styled the Mid-Heaven Proclamation of verses 6 and 7. It's styled the Mid-Heaven Proclamation because it's described as an angel which flies in the middle of heaven having the everlasting gospel to preach. The angel referred to in verses 6 and 7, the angel referred to in verse 8, and the angel referred to in verse 9 are all the same group. We've come to realise this now, haven't we? Because it is a thematic study. It is God manifestation which is being revealed to us. And it's the same group manifesting itself in a different series of events. So then we don't have to say, well, if it's one angel that performs the mid-heaven work, then it's got to be a different angel that destroys Babylon and another angel again that destroys them that worship the beast. Not so. It's the same group, just described under a different heading, because, after all, it's a different series of events. Now, this angel, then, flying in the midst of heaven, whatever the midst of heaven might be, just for the moment, we'll come to that in a minute, the fact is they are taking out the everlasting gospel. Now, as soon as we read everlasting gospel, we automatically think in terms of, well, it was the gospel preached to Abraham. Well, that's not entirely untrue, but it's certainly not the whole truth. We've got to take each word in its setting. The word gospel means good news. The word everlasting here means the aeonian good news, or the good news of the age. Now, what was the good news of the age that the Lord would take out to the nations at this particular time? Well, the good news was simply this, that it was a national type of good news. The good news it described in verse 7 is that if you are prepared to fear God and give glory to him, then you will be saved as nations. So in a sense, it is a national invitation. By extension also, of course, it will be an invitation which will go out to individuals to accept the true gospel as well. But the everlasting gospel here happens to be the good news of this particular time. And so whenever you come across the word gospel, it's got to be interpreted in the context. Now, 99 times out of 100, it's going to be the things concerning the kingdom of God and the name of Jesus Christ. But in this particular case, the good news which is taken out is the fact that the Lord is now reigning in Zion. It's essentially Psalm 2, which we might turn back to, because Psalm 2 is in fact a very, very good summary of the situation which will exist when the Lord has established himself in Zion, preparatory to subduing all of the nations. In other words, he's overthrown the Gogian host, and he's now about to send out his ambassadors to offer salvation or judgment, whichever they should choose, unto the nations. We can take it up from verse 6. Well, we'll start from the beginning. It's only a short one. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against Yahweh and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. So you see, although Gog's been overthrown, the Catholic nations of Europe haven't experienced this except only in an indirect way. And therefore they say, you know, why do we have to necessarily accept this? But he that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. Yahweh shall have them in derision. Then shall he speak unto them in his wrath and vex them in his sore displeasure. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree. Yahweh hath said unto me, thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. Ask of me, and I shall give thee the heathen for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. So, you see, he's already set the king in Zion, and then he says to him, ask of me, and I'll give you the uttermost parts of the earth for your possession. So he's enthroned there, but he has not yet brought the whole earth into subjection. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron, a term we find in the Apocalypse. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. We also find that in the Apocalypse. Be wise now, therefore, O ye kings, and be instructed, ye judges of the earth. Serve Yahweh with fear, and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son. The word there can literally mean to subject yourself or to be ruled by the Son, lest he be angry, and ye perish from the way when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are all they that put their trust in him. Now that's a beautiful parallel to what we've got here in Revelation 14, verses 6 to 11. It deals mainly with this merciful proclamation of verses 6 and 7, where the nations are invited to submit. And that's what we've got here. And so they are told, submit, because if you don't submit, he might become angry. He will, of course, become angry, but he might become angry with them. So if they submit, they have no fear, no need to be concerned about fearing his anger, which will be poured out in the events of the next two angels. So then, this is the situation we've got back in Revelation chapter 14. The angel which is referred to in each of these cases is this rainbowed angel, which we've previously considered in Revelation chapter 10. As we've mentioned before, Revelation chapter 10 and Revelation 14 in essence are very similar chapters as far as the events they describe are concerned, but they are found as the culminating vision of different themes. And the vision of chapter 10 happens to be the culminating vision of the trumpets, whereas the vision of chapter 14 is the culminating vision of the development of Christendom as described in chapters 12 and 13. So whilst in essence many of the events are the same, the theme and the aspect in which it is being looked at is different. so that, you know, Revelation chapter 10 was looking very much at the specific judgments which were going to be poured out upon nations, whereas Revelation chapter 14 is looking at the judgments going to be poured out on system, the system being Babylon, the system of Babylon being the culmination of these various beasts, the great red dragon of chapter 12, the beast of the sea of the early part of chapter 13, the beast of the earth of the latter part of chapter 13, and the image of the beast, all culminating in a system to be destroyed. Now, can you follow the idea? Revelation chapter 10 is the culminating vision of a judgment upon a geographical locality, upon specific nations, whereas Revelation chapter 14 is a judgment upon a system. You say, what's the difference? Rome's a system, Rome's a nation. Correct. That's why Revelation 14 and Revelation 10 can be seen as similar chapters, if you want to see them as similar chapters. But if you want to see them as similar chapters, you may miss the theme of the apocalypse. And at the risk of repeating the thing over and over and over again, we're not looking at events, we're looking at themes. We're looking at God manifestation. So the manifestational theme, if you like, of Revelation 14 is the judgment to be poured out upon a system, namely the apostate system of religion. That's why, of course, the saints are commended in these early verses, because they haven't allied themselves with this woman, which is the system. Okay, so Revelation 14 verses 6 and 7 still are prepared to offer that system and the rest of the world mercy if they are prepared to accept it. So the angel then, the rainbowed angel, as similarly described in chapter 10, but now seen in a different aspect of its work, is going to go out and it's going to fly in the midst of heaven. Brother Thomas states that Babylon occupies a middle station between the worshippers of the beast, described in verse 9, that is the powers of Europe, and the new throne which is established in Zion. This is how he suggests we get this term mid-heaven. There is the heaven of Babylon, and there is the heaven of the heaven which is established in Zion, the heaven of the Lord Jesus Christ. And so the system of Babylon itself occupies what he styles a middle station. You'll see I've got this paraphrase here in the notes on page 150. It occupies a middle station between the worshippers of the beast and the new throne which is established in Zion. It goes on to say that the good news or gospel, which proclaims divine mercy upon those who will submit, but warns of impending judgment upon those who will not. did I miss a line there? The good news of gospel, the good news of gospel, which is taken to the world, is not the gospel, but a gospel. It proclaims divine mercy upon those who will submit, but warns of impending judgment on those who will not. And that's, of course, the statement we've made before. To look at the mechanics of the thing, which I don't want to really do in length, we want to really keep the theme, but the mechanics are important for those, perhaps the younger ones here, who may not have studied it. The means by which this will be accomplished is doubtless associated with the work of Elijah, the sending forth of that group to perform a certain work amongst the nations, part of that work being the regathering of Israel. Now, when we talk about the work of Elijah, we generally immediately think of the regathering of Israel. But the regathering of Israel is only one half of this particular work. See, if we go back to Ezekiel chapter 20, which is one of those very important key passages in the study of the work of the second Exodus and the work of Elijah, you'll see that implicit in this there is another series of events which must be taking place at the same time as the gathering of Israel. Now, this is the gathering of Israel after Armageddon. Let's start from verse 33. As I live, saith the Lord Yahweh, surely with a mighty hand and with a stretched out arm and with fury poured out will I rule over you. And I will bring you out from the people and will gather you out of the countries wherein you are scattered, with a mighty hand and with a stretched out arm and with fury poured out. Now, that might seem a bit strange, does it? He's going to gather them, but he's gathering them in fury. I will bring you into the wilderness of the people, and there will I plead with you face to face. Like as I pleaded with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt, so will I plead with you, saith the Lord Yahweh. And I will cause you to pass under the rod, and I will bring you into the bond of the covenant, and I will purge out from among you the rebels, and them that transgress against me. I will bring them forth out of the country where they sojourn, and they shall not enter into the land of Israel, and ye shall know that I am Yahweh. So that the gathering of Israel is going to involve a purging process, a pouring out of fury, a passing under the rod, and a bringing into the bond of the covenant. The bringing into the bond of the covenant is the last stage after there has been a purging. And so God is going to use the nations of the earth to purge Israel. If we go over to Zechariah, who speaks of the way in which Yahweh is going to use these, we go over, for example, to Zechariah chapter 9, Zechariah chapter 9 and verse 13, which says, when I have bent Judah for me, Judah being those of Israel, can't say that, can I? Judah being those of the Jewish people who have been saved at Armageddon, in other words, those who are in the land at the time of Armageddon and have been saved out of it, and who will constitute, incidentally, part of this angel which is going forth with the proclamation, the so-called refined third of Judah, those who have been refined at Armageddon. He says, I'll use them as my bow, and I'll fill my bow with Ephraim, Ephraim being the leading tribe of the ten tribes, and being used here to describe those of Israel who are to be gathered back after Armageddon. So Judah are those in the land at Armageddon who are saved. Israel or Ephraim are those who are still amongst the nations who are to be brought back. He says, I'm going to make Judah the bow, and I'm going to make Israel the arrow that I put into that bow. And we read in verse 14, and Yahweh shall be seen over them, and his arrow shall go forth as the lightning, and the Lord Yahweh shall blow the trumpet, and shall go with the whirlwinds of the south. So as he has said over in chapter 13, and verse 8, which was not exactly the quote that I wanted, but that one will do. There was a quote which says, I will save the tents of Judah first. Where that's there somewhere, isn't it? Where's that quote? Chapter 12, verse 7. Thank you. Yes, chapter 12, verse 7. Yahweh also shall save the tents of Judah first. So those are the ones that are saved at Armageddon. And then we're told over in chapter 13 and at verse 8, that it shall come to pass that in all the land, saith Yahweh, two parts therein shall be cut off and die, but the third shall be left therein, and I'll bring them through the refining fire. So Judah, having been refined at Armageddon, they then constitute the bow that Yahweh is going to use, which he is going to fill with these of Israel that he's going to gather out of the nations. Now the bow is that which fires the weapon, whereas the arrow itself is that which inflicts the wound. So Judah, already having been refined, they go out as part of the ambassadorial group, part of this angel. You see, we've already seen there in Zechariah 10, or Zechariah 9 rather, that Yahweh shall be seen over them. So they will be under the guidance of the saints. Now, if we've got this picture then of the angel proclamation going forth as being under the leadership of Elijah, combined with some of the refined third of Judah who are to be used in this task, and of course the saints, styled here the Yahweh which is seen over them, they go out and they gather Israel. Now Israel is going to become an arrow. That arrow then is going to go out and inflict a wound upon the nations, but at the same time Ezekiel has told us that the nations will fight back. So there's a two-way thing happening here. Israel is going to inflict a wound upon the nations. The nations are also going to inflict wounds upon these gathered ones of Israel, so that the rebels will be purged out. And in the providence of God, he will no doubt oversee that those who are purged out are the rebels, and that those who are to be saved will come through it safely. So there is to be a refining process of Israel, but at the same time, there's going to be a judgment being poured out upon the nations. So during this 40-year period, I'm talking about the overall period in a general sense, it can be broken down into smaller components again. During this 40-year period between Armageddon and the actual completion of the subjugation of the nations, when eventually all Israel will be brought back to the land and the temple opened, there is going to be this period of warfare during which Israel will be purged, but the nations will likewise be judged. Now I'm jumping ahead a little bit because we should still be looking at the merciful proclamation. That's going to be the ultimate result. But the first message that this angel takes out is a message of invitation. It will be a message of invitation in two senses. It will be an invitation to the people of Israel to come out of Babylon, which is not stated in this chapter but is later on in Revelation. But the theme of this chapter is principally an invitation to the nations to accept the king who is reigning in Zion. Some nations will accept that invitation. We are told, for example, in Psalm 72, Psalm that you probably know very well, that the kings of Sheba and Seba shall offer gifts, the kings of Tarshish shall bring gifts. Tarshish in particular is one of those sheep nations that will accept the merciful proclamation which goes out from Zion. And they will assist, therefore, the people of Israel to come back to the land. That's why Isaiah 60 speaks of the ships of Tarshish, which will bring the daughters and sons of Israel from afar. But there's one chapter which we might have a look at, which is probably not quite so well known as some of these others, and that's the 17th and 18th chapters of Isaiah. The last verses of chapter 17 in particular, and the opening verses of chapter 18. And this presents to us another picture of these events, so very much in parallel with the theme of the apocalypse. So we take the theme up from Isaiah chapter 17, verse 12. Woe to the multitude of many people, or it's better rendered, ho to the noise of many people, which make a noise like the noise of the seas, and to the rushing of nations that make a rushing like the rushing of mighty waters. So this takes us back a little bit earlier to the time of trouble, when the nations are like the sea and the waves which are roaring. Verse 13, the nations shall rush like the rushing of many waters, but God shall rebuke them, and they shall flee far off, and they shall be chased as the chaff of the mountains before the wind, and like a rolling thing before the whirlwind. Now what's that the theme of? They shall be chased as the chaff of the mountains before the wind, and like a rolling thing before the whirlwind. Well, it's Armageddon, isn't it? Armageddon, a heap of sheaves and a valley for judgment. Those sheaves are going to be reaped, the stubble is going to be burned, the chaff's going to be blown away. You know, Daniel 2, Micah 4, Revelation 16, Joel 3, and here again in Isaiah 17. It's this theme of Armageddon that keeps coming in all the time. So verses 12 and 13 then speak to us about these events which are going to build up to Armageddon. And so the nations are going to be chased as the chaff of the mountains before the wind, and like a rolling thing before the whirlwind. The term rolling thing there is to, it says thistle down here, but there's a particular plant in Israel, I can't think of the name at the moment, but I've seen a picture of it, and it sort of blows itself up into balls, and it rolls along the ground, and it just sort of eventually blows itself away. And Yahweh says, that's what I'm going to do to the nations. Now, verse 14 is a particularly interesting one. It says, behold, at eveningtide, trouble. And before the morning, he is not. Now, there's a whole lot of events condensed into that verse. Eveningtide. Now, the eveningtide is the period of the time of trouble. It's the evening time of, it's the time of the end. It's the end of the times of the Gentiles. The times of the Gentiles are coming to an end. And they are brought to an end as a result of a time of trouble, such as never was. Now these verses here have been principally speaking about the destruction of this Gogian host. So at the evening tide of the time of the end, Gog will come to an end. And before the morning he comes to his nought. He comes to his end. Why before the morning? Well, what does the morning represent? Again, we've done this in the Apocalypse, haven't we? All of the themes of the Apocalypse are drawn from the Scriptures. The morning, of course, is the morning that dawns without clouds. Now, to get to the stage of the morning without clouds, we've got to have a lot of other events take place between the evening tide trouble and the morning, don't we? Because, you know, the clouds are going to be formed as a result of the resurrected saints represented by the dew. The clouds will have been formed by the evaporation. They will be the thunder clouds of Revelation 4. There will be the thundering and there will be the lightning. The nations will be judged. The rain will then come down upon the mown grass. And then when the morning comes, it will be the morning without clouds. And when that morning comes, you're not going to have Gog there. He's got to be gone before the morning, because